Content note, in this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time, references to a dental procedure, to eugenics, to murder, and to some other delightful themes, including some deeper exploration of ideological differences in schools of thought when it comes to the individual, the collective, and society, and so on and so forth, which some may find troubling to hear. Hi, folks. This is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Today we continue with Madeleine Eng's A Wrinkle in Time with Chapter 8, The Transparent Column.
My columns opaque.
Opaque, transparent. Yeah. No, what was the other word? It's okay.
Unless opaque. We're talking about Excel, I don't want cells of black because then you can't see what's in them.
But, no, kinda, sorta. No, yeah, it's not a unless you use high contrast. But yes, rather than amusing you with our spreadsheet anecdotes, how have you been doing?
but I excel at them.
Oh no! Oof.
I'm okay, a bit flat.
Opaque? No, that's the word.
Actually, emotionally, I'm usually pretty opaque. Yes, opaque. I don't allow people to see into my. You have to pry my emotions out of me.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm familiar with that process. Have you been, for listeners, as we just divulge our, psychological things, one of the things, an exercise that I know multiple psychologists have tried to get me to do, and one of them with varying success, I literally had one say, it's like pulling teeth out of you. Sorry about the dentistry reference, but it is incredibly difficult for me to talk about emotions. I can talk about how I think. I can talk about all sorts of stuff, but feelings are a tricky topic. I'm with you. There's an exercise that one of the recent ones does is sit down and just do a check-in and try and identify what it is that you're feeling. Narrow it down, like have a sheet of emotional words, like words that are emotions, and try and narrow down what ballpark it you're in, and even just staying and just doing that for a little bit and writing it down, and just that stage one. And then he builds up, it's like, okay, now next thing is to figure out why you're feeling that way, even if it's like identifying a particular thing that might be occupying your mind that is causing that particular emotional response. Not as in, why do I feel upset about XYZ? It's like, what is it that's making me feel upset? Oh, that. Huh. Okay. And not going into too much depth. Just acknowledging it, sitting there going, okay, I'm feeling a bit frustrated today. Okay. Because my computer crashed like 10 times in a row and I needed to work for an assignment. Okay, yeah, that's that. And go, yeah, it's a reasonable kind of situation. And the option of actually addressing it and saying, what is it that I can do? What is it that, what are my options and steps? But to try and not go straight into the problem solving, really hard. Really hard. And I think I can't speak for all people who are neurodivergent, but I'm wondering if it is a thing that we have a very, I don't know if it's a neurodivergence thing or if it's just generally the society in which we live, we want to fix everything. But yeah, getting to that mindset of I've got to fix it.
Well, if you focus more on your thoughts than your emotions, thoughts are more in the realm of problem solving.
And that's why it's easier for me to discuss thoughts than it is actually sitting in the feeling and identifying what the feeling is. And part of that is the whole living in the autistic kind of range of things. But also, I mean, life and people don't want to everyone has some sort of like level of things that are hard to process and skills that we need to develop. And sometimes we develop them a bit later, and some of them it's like, again, pulling teeth to get us to start developing them. And it's just simply we're not. Cultural factors, it's psychological factors, it's a whole bunch of stuff. Fear of vulnerability is always a big one, and that's a fairly universal challenge. We have fear of vulnerability, insecurities, fears of being perceived as something less, even though my favorite saying from the psychologist so far is, you are human and you are allowed to feel things. You like just sit there and acknowledging that you are human means that you are not only capable, it is normal for you to have emotional responses to things. You can just decide whether you're going to respond with the action that, like, what action is an appropriate response to that emotional situation or that feeling, so to speak. That's where the cognitive stuff comes in and the higher thinking and da da da. But yeah, it's footnote, I am not a psychologist, I've just been to a fair few. So I have seen all sorts of different approaches, and I like the psychologists that acknowledge that not one approach is a solution for everyone or everything, and that you actually end up having to use a mixed bag of tools and work using that, navigating the world using that. That seems like a more holistic approach, I guess. But yes, so opaque Dave, and I do the distraction dance. Are you familiar with the distraction dance?
No.
There's a, I think it's from Dr. Doofen, maybe Dr. Doofen, from, what's it called? I can only think Perry the Platypus, why am I forgetting? Yeah, Phineas and Ferb. There's a character who's kind of meant to be evil genius, but look, sort of. And he does a distraction dance to distract them from stuff
that's okay.
Going on. Yeah, so there's a distraction dance. It's a very popular thing. Yes, distraction dance. So I am distraction dance Roo. You are opaque Dave. You're like, no. It has been a little bit of time because we had some unforeseen circumstances last week. Yeah. Without going into too much detail, something that would make my physio nauseated to discuss. So my hip decided not to play ball. Or ball and socket, so to speak. My hip did not like, it did not want to hold onto my leg properly anymore. And it said, nah. And that's one of the more painful, for anyone out there who's got a connective tissue disorder or who knows what it feels like to have your hip not sit correctly, like the leg not sit correctly in the hip socket. Yeah. That. Ugh. So Dave's like, what's up? Let's record. And me, so Dave.
Yeah. And then the next day when we were going to, I just felt completely run down. So much so that I got one of those rat tests because I'm like, this feels extra problematic. Luckily, it came back negative, and I guess I just needed to sleep a whole deal.
Yeah, bodies, that's something, folks, that's coming up, and it is fresh in my mind because I had a whole discussion with my physio about it, and she's like, why do people not know this? So I don't know if you need to know this, but when you get sick and your body is saying, I'm a bit fatigued now, that's a sign that you need to rest because your immune system is working hard and it needs the energy reserves to be going towards that, which means that you need to rest and recoup. And that also involves resting whilst you're recovering post-virally. Of course, that need might reduce slowly, but please listen to that signal because it's not doing it for funsies. There is a reason. Body needs rest. I think that it was a necessity that your body said, nope, I'm crashing now and you're going to crash with me. And you go, that's very inconvenient, but fine. Yeah, I think this is something we have an advantage as time progresses. Some of us get better at learning that lesson. It's something that you ignore often when you're younger because you go, oh no, but I want to get all these things done. And you just push through, and that's a mistake. And a lot of people who are older do the same thing, but we're in that age of we're discovering this and going, wait a second.
Well, there's the little iffy thing as well where, you know, like at the moment I'm working a job 9 to 1 Monday to Friday. And like, you know, I felt pretty bad on Friday morning, but it's like I'm still in that stage or, you know, in that mindset where I can't really call in. Yeah. Even though that's something we all need to get over. If you're sick, you really should stay home and just rest. We all need it. But, you know, like I have no paid days off and it's tied up in other things. And, you know, I'm still relatively new there. And all these are excuses, I know, ultimately. But you know, the culture at large still like, no, don't take time off from your job.
Yeah, and I think that's what the thing is here. It's like we're talking, we know there are certain things that we need to learn and that are important physically and that are important socially and emotionally, mentally, all these things. But then you've got this pulsing, I guess, this dictation that is sometimes subtle and sometimes very obvious as to what the cultural norms are. And they're sneaky. At times they are very sneaky. Sometimes they're very blatant, but sometimes they're sneaky. And the pressure to conform to it, of course, is very high. Which brings us...
Nice.
Nice segue. Yeah, there we go. Segue. So segueing into this week's chapter. So last week we had the red-eyed dude. So we had the experience with the man with red eyes, which is probably not the title of the chapter, and I need to actually look at it because that's how my brain does not recall things that easily right now. The man with red eyes. So yes, we had our man with red eyes, and I'm now finding this space again. I should have remembered the page. And, we had a whole situation where the guy was talking to them without talking to them. There was food that tasted like sand and grit to Charles Wallace because he was not letting the guy in. And the first time he tried, the first time that he tried to allow the guy to get into his mind or whatever was acting through the guy to get into his mind, Meg interrupted. I don't know. There's other things that happened. Dave, are there any particular pertinent things that that really stood out
in your mind? I mean, really, it in the end, Charles Wallace thought that he'd be able to fight the man with the red eyes because he just had to know who he was. This was the easiest way to find out that. And Meg was completely against it because, you know, she, whether or not she's right, she's like, he's too powerful. There's no way you can win. And Charles was pretty adamant that I think I can save a part of me, which, you know, makes sense to me because ultimately, you know, for a story, he's got to come back somehow, some way. And to have a bit of Charles tucked away if he's overtaken, obviously there'll be a fight going on and he's got to claw back. But yes, for all intents and purposes, from the outward, it looks like Charles Wallace at the end was taken over, even now more so than Meg and Calvin, because
Well, they're not taken over. Meg and Calvin, they could let him in a little bit, but he can't take over their brains. Because as he said, like their brains might explode, or their brains would definitely explode, and Charles's might explode. Was the thing. You're like, it's a kid. It's a 5-year-old kid. That's the level of callousness that we have to also be aware, like, think about. That this being was quite happy to take the risk on probably won't blow up his brain.
For science.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of, like, there's layers to this that were pretty rough.
Actually, that's the wrong word. Considering what this man represents, I think the more insidious thing to say would be for progress.
Yes, for progress or control. It was all about you know, just give up everything. Like, you don't have to make decisions. You don't have to do anything. I can make all those. You never have to suffer because you never have to choose.
Even though everyone who lives in Kamazots is terrified out of their mind of even sneezing or looking in the wrong direction.
Yes, they can't break the pattern, and it's all rather nasty. But yes, in the meantime, so we've now reached a point where Charles Wallace has decided to sit back at the table, and it brings to mind, for all our Simpsons, those who are familiar with the Simpsons, and particularly the episode where, I think it's one of the Tree Shop of Horrors, possibly? Tree House of Horrors. I was thinking of the Little Shop of Horrors. It became Tree Shop of Horrors.
Seymour! Well, there is a Seymour in both.
Yes. But this one was, it was more that scene where, you know, it's like, join us, it's bliss. You know, that kind of...
Oh, yeah. When they get their brains taken out by Flanders.
Yes.
So it's like, bliss!
Yes. So joining that kind of, like, you don't have to make decisions. The decisions, your behavior will be completely dictated and controlled. And there's no depth of thought or reflection. And we saw how Meg and Calvin resisted by being just completely random, by projecting random things. Meg also, just by her very nature of no.
Her faults, her stubbornness saved her.
Yeah. And so far, Calvin and Meg have been doing their best to adhere to the advice of the three wise creatures. So Mrs. Witch, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. What's It. So they've tried to actually adhere, like, stick true to that advice. Whereas Charles Wallace, by his nature, was very vulnerable, as they pointed out. You are the most vulnerable here. And which is, I think, also flip side.
Do you think that's because of his age or just the personality?
I think it's who he is, what he is. It's both. He has an incredible mind. He's a evolutionarily advanced human, as said in this particular context. Has a thirst for knowledge. needs to understand everything. Right? That in itself is not a problem. But if the way that you understand things is restricted and limited to only a certain approach, as in, I need to know absolutely all the facts before I can actually understand, as opposed to inference. Like, anyway, so it's a bit more... there's layers to his character that make him vulnerable. Part of it is also he's really nervous about, like, he doesn't have what Meg has, which is Meg knows their father and is longing for their father and has had a relationship. Whereas Charles Wallace's relationship with the father is one of, maybe he won't even like me, kind of. He doesn't, like, I never really, like, I don't remember him knowing me. Whereas his father, of course, knew him and loved him. It's just he was too young to know or to have that relationship. So there's things like that. And Calvin is interesting because he longs for that also relationship and connection. But he's wanting it for them. And also he wants to do something for others. And he's fighting through the fear because he knows that there's a need, that things need to happen. Things need to be done. And he wants to, of course, also protect Meg and Charles Wallace. So it's, if anything comes out of this book, the big thing is also the importance of fostering those relationships between human beings, like that makes a difference to, rather than this passive dictation of what that looks like. But and so Charles Wallace, previously, the food looked tasted like chewing cardboard and dust. And now we have the transparent column. Charles Wallace sat there, tucking away turkey and dressing, as though it were the most delicious thing he had ever tasted. He was dressed like Charles Wallace. He looked like Charles Wallace. He had the same sandy brown hair, the same face that had not yet lost its baby roundness. Only the eyes were different, for the black was still swallowed up in blue. But it was far more than this that made Meg feel that Charles Wallace was gone, that the little boy in his place was only a copy of Charles Wallace, only a doll. She fought down a sob. "Where is he?" she demanded of the man with red eyes. "What have you done with him? Where is Charles Wallace?" "But, my dear child, you are hysterical," the man thought at her. "He is right there before you, well and happy, completely well and happy, for the first time in his life. And he is finishing his dinner, which you also would be wise to do." "You know it isn't Charles," Meg shouted. "You've got him somehow." "Hush, Meg. There's no use trying to talk to him," Calvin said, speaking in a low voice into her ear. "What we have to do is hold Charles Wallace tight. He's there, somewhere underneath, and we mustn't let them take him away from us. Help me hold him, Meg. Don't lose control yourself, not now. You've got to help me hold Charles." He took the little boy firmly by one arm. Fighting down her hysteria, Meg took Charles's other arm and held it tightly. I'm going to step aside here right now and say that a legitimate anxiety and distress is not hysteria. I dislike that word so much. I mean, okay. I get why it's being used. That when you are, when just literally a few paragraphs before, it was used to dismiss her like valid concern for her sibling,
When this was written, I imagine that was still a common diagnosis for agitated women.
Yes. It's a dismissive kind of term. Unfortunately, it no longer has, it never was a particularly good word, but it's got a very negative connotation in the sense of it's used to dismiss concerns.
I mainly know it as a muse song.
Yes. People use it to ignore and say, "Oh, you're just being hysterical," when someone says something that is a valid concern.
Don't be hysterical. Yeah.
Yeah. It's dismissive. Anyway, so "You're hurting me, Meg," Charles said sharply. "Let me go." "No," Meg said grimly. "We've been all wrong." Charles Wallace's voice, Meg thought, might have been a recording. There was a canned quality to it. "He isn't an enemy at all. He's our friend." "Nuts," Calvin said rudely. "You don't understand, Calvin," Charles Wallace said. "Mrs. Watsit, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch have confused us. They're the ones who are really our enemies. We never should have trusted them for a minute." He spoke in his calmest, most reasonable voice, the voice which infuriated the twins. He seemed to be looking directly at Calvin as he spoke. And yet Meg was sure that the bland blue eyes could not see, and that someone, something else, was looking at Calvin through Charles. Now the cold, strange eyes turned to her. "Meg, let go. I will explain it all to you, but you must let go." "No," Meg gritted her teeth. She did not release her grasp, and Charles Wallace began to pull away with a power that was not his own, and her own spindly strength was no match against it. "Calvin," she gasped, as Charles Wallace wrenched his arm from her and stood up. Calvin the athlete, Calvin the boy who split firewood and brought it in for his mother, whose muscles were strong and controlled, let go Charles Wallace's wrist and tackled him as though he were a football. Meg, in her panic and rage, darted at the man on the chair, intending to hit him as Charles Wallace had done. But the black-smocked men were too quick for her, and one of them held her with her arms pinioned behind her back. "Calvin, I advise you to let me go," came Charles Wallace's voice from under Calvin. Calvin, his face screwed up with grim determination, did not relax his hold. The man with the red eyes nodded, and three of the men moved in on Calvin. At least it took three of them, pried him loose, and held him as Meg was being held. "Mrs. Watsit," Meg called despairingly. "Oh, Mrs. Watsit." Mrs. Watsit did not come. "Meg," Charles Wallace said. "Meg, just listen to me."
"Okay, I'm listening."
"We've been all wrong, I told you. We haven't understood. We've been fighting our friend and Father's friend." "If Father tells me he's our friend, maybe I'll believe it. Maybe. Unless he's got Father under a spell or whatever it is, like you." "This isn't a fairy tale. Spells indeed," Charles Wallace said. "Meg, you've got to stop fighting and relax. Relax and be happy." "Oh, Meg, if you'd just relax, you'd realize that all our troubles are over. You don't understand what a wonderful place we've come to. You see, on this planet, everything is in perfect order because everybody has learned to relax, to give in, to submit. All you have to do is look quietly and steadily into the eyes of our good friend here, for he is our friend, dear sister, and he will take you in as he has taken me."
"Taking you in is right," Meg said. "You know you are not you. You know you've never in your life called me dear sister."
"Shut up a minute, Meg," Calvin whispered to her. He looked up at the man with red eyes.
"Okay, have your henchmen let us go and stop talking to us through Charles. We know it's you talking or whatever's talking through you. Anyhow, we know you have Charles hypnotized."
"A most primitive way of putting it," the man with red eyes murmured. He gestured slightly with one finger, and Meg and Calvin were released.
"Thanks," Calvin said wryly. "Now, if you are our friend, will you tell us who or what you are?"
"It is not necessary for you to know who I am. I am the Prime Coordinator. That is all you need to know."
"But you're being spoken through, aren't you? Just like Charles Wallace. Are you hypnotized, too?"
"I told you that was too primitive a word without the correct connotations."
"Is it you who are going to take us to Mr. Murray?"
"No, it is not necessary, nor is it possible for me to leave here. Charles Wallace will conduct you."
"Charles Wallace?"
"Yes.
When?"
"Now."
The man with red eyes made the frightening grimace that passed for his smile.
"Yes, I think it might as well be now."
Charles Wallace gave a slight jerk of his head, saying, "Come," and started to walk in a strange, gliding, mechanical manner. Calvin followed him. Meg hesitated, looking from the man with red eyes to Charles and Calvin. She wanted to reach out and grab Calvin's hand, but it seemed that ever since they had begun their journeying, she had been looking for a hand to hold. So she stuffed her fist into her pockets and walked along behind the two boys.
"I've got to be brave," she said to herself. "I will be."
They moved down a long, white, and seemingly endless corridor. Charles Wallace continued the jerky rhythm of his walk and did not once look back to see if they were with him. Suddenly, Meg broke into a run and caught up with Calvin.
"Cal," she said, "listen.
Quick, remember, Mrs. Watsit said your gift was communication, and that was what she was giving you. We've been trying to fight Charles physically, and that isn't any good. Can't you try to communicate with him? Can't you try to get into him?"
"Golly day, you're right." Calvin's face lit up with hope, and his eyes, which had been somber, regained their usual sparkle. "I've been in such a swivet. It may not do any good, but at least I can try."
They quickened their pace until they were level with Charles Wallace. Calvin reached out for his arm, but Charles flung it off.
"Leave me alone," he snarled.
"I'm not going to hurt you, old sport," Calvin said. "I'm just trying to be friendly. Let's make it up, huh?"
"You mean you're coming around?" Charles Wallace asked.
"Sure," Calvin's voice was coaxing. "We are reasonable people, after all. Just look at me for a minute, Charlibus." Charles Wallace stopped and turned slowly to look at Calvin with his cold, vacant eyes. Calvin looked back, and Meg could feel the intensity of his concentration. An enormous shudder shook Charles Wallace. For a brief flash his eyes seemed to see, then his whole body twirled wildly and went rigid. He started his marionette's walk again, "I should have known better," he said. "If you want to see Murray, you'd better come with me, and not try any more hanky-panky." "Is that what you call your father, Murray?" Carvin asked. Meg could see that he was angry and upset at his near success. "Father? What is a father?" Charles Wallace intoned. "Merely another misconception. If you feel the need of a father, then I would suggest that you turn to it."
It again.
"Who's this it?" Meg asked.
"All in good time," Charles Wallace said.
"You're not ready for it yet. First of all, I will tell you something about this beautiful, enlightened planet of Camazotz." His voice took on the dry, pedantic tones of Mr. Jenkins. "Perhaps you do not realize that on Camazotz we have conquered all illness, all deformity."
"We?" Calvin interrupted.
Charles continued as though he had not heard. And of course he hadn't, Meg thought. "We let no one suffer. It is so much kinder simply to annihilate anyone who is ill. Nobody has weeks and weeks of runny noses and sore throats. Rather than endure such discomfort, they are simply put to sleep."
"You mean they're put to sleep while they have a cold, or that they're murdered?" Calvin demanded.
"Murder is a most primitive word," Charles Wallace said. "There is no such thing as murder on Camazotz. It takes care of all such things." He moved jerkily to the wall of the corridor, stood still for a moment, then raised his hand. The wall flickered, quivered, grew transparent. Charles Wallace walked through it, beckoned to Meg and Calvin, and they followed. They were in a small square room, from which radiated a dull, sulphurous light. There was something ominous to Meg in the very compactness of the room, as though the walls, the ceiling, the floor might move together and crush anybody rash enough to enter.
"How did you do that?" Calvin asked Charles.
"Do what?"
"Make the wall open like that."
"I merely rearranged the atoms," Charles Wallace said loftily. "You've studied atoms at school, haven't you?"
"Sure, but..."
"Then you know enough to know that matter isn't solid, don't you? That you, Calvin, consist mostly of empty space. That if all the matter in you came together, you'd be the size of the head of a pin. That's plain scientific fact, isn't it?"
"Yes, but..."
"So I simply pushed the atoms aside, and we walked through the space between them."
Meg's stomach seemed to drop, and she realized that the square box in which they stood must be an elevator, and that they had started to move upward with great speed. The yellow light lit up their faces, and the pale blue of Charles's eyes absorbed the yellow and turned green. Calvin licked his lips.
"Where are we going?"
"Up," Charles continued his lecture.
"On Camazotz, we are all happy because we are all alike. Differences create problems. You know that, don't you, dear sister?"
"No," Meg said.
"Oh, yes, you do. You've seen at home how true it is. You know that's the reason you're not happy at school, because you're different."
"I'm different and I'm happy," Calvin said.
"But you pretend that you aren't different."
"I'm different, and I like being different." Calvin's voice was unnaturally loud.
"Maybe I don't like being different," Meg said, "but I don't want to be like everybody else either."
Charles Wallace raised his hand, and the motion of the square box ceased, and one of the walls seemed to disappear. Charles stepped out, Meg and Calvin following him. Calvin just barely making it before the wall came into being again, and they could no longer see where the opening had been.
"You wanted Calvin to get left behind, didn't you?" Meg said.
"I am merely trying to teach you to stay on your toes. I warn you, if I have any more trouble from either of you, I shall have to take you to it."
As the word "it" fell from Charles's lips again, Meg felt as though she had been touched by something slimy and horrible.
"So what is this it?" she asked.
"You might call it the boss." Then Charles Wallace giggled. A giggle that was the most sinister sound Meg had ever heard. "It sometimes calls itself the happiest sadist."
"Oh, wow, that is a visual pun, not an auditory pun.
Because it's the happiest and then it's sadist, S-A-D, happiest sad, happiest sadist, that is the joke.
It is a terrible joke, but it is a joke.
I never actually put that together. That, yeah, kind of the root word of sadist is the word sad, like they delight in inflicting sadness.
Yeah, so it's going to explain the joke now, so you might want to edit this bit out, but yes. Meg spoke coldly to cover her fear. I don't know what you're talking about. That's S-A-D-I-S-T, not S-A-D-D-E-S-T, you know, Charles Wallace said, and giggled again. Lots of people don't pronounce it correctly. Well, I don't care, Meg said defiantly. I don't ever want to see it, and that's that. Charles Wallace's strange, monotonous voice ground against her ears. Meg, you're supposed to have some mind. Why do you think we have wars at home? Why do you think people get confused and unhappy? Because they all live their own separate individual lives. I've been trying to explain to you in the simplest possible way that on Kamazots, individuals have been done away with. Kamazots is one mind. It's it. And that's why everybody's so happy and efficient. That's what old witches like Mrs. Watsit don't want to have happen at home. She's not a witch, Meg interrupted. No, no, Calvin said. You know she's not. You know that's just their game. Their way, maybe, of laughing in the dark. In the dark is correct, Charles continued. They want us to go on being confused instead of properly organized. Meg shook her head violently. No, she shouted. I know our world isn't perfect, Charles, but it's better than this. This isn't the only alternative. It can't be. Nobody suffers here, Charles intoned. Nobody is ever unhappy. But nobody's ever happy either, Meg said earnestly. Maybe if you aren't unhappy sometimes, you don't know how to be happy. Calvin, I want to go home. We can't leave Charles, Calvin told her, and we can't go before we found your father. You know that, but you're right, Meg, and Mrs. Witch is right. This is evil. Charles Wallace shook his head, and scorn and disapproval seemed to emanate from him. Come, we're wasting time. He moved rapidly down the corridor, but continued to speak. How dreadful it is to be low individual organisms. His pace quickened from step to step, his short legs flashing, so that Meg and Calvin almost had to run to keep up with him. Now see this, he said. He raised his hand, and suddenly they could see through one of the walls into a small room. In the room, a small boy was bouncing a ball. He was bouncing in rhythm, and the walls of his little cell seemed to pulse with the rhythm of the ball. And each time the ball bounced, he screamed as though he were in pain. That's the little boy we saw this afternoon, Calvin said sharply. The little boy who wasn't bouncing the ball like the others. Charles Wallace giggled again. Yes, every once in a while there's a little trouble with cooperation, but it's easily taken care of. After today, he'll never desire to deviate again. Ah, here we are. He moved rapidly down the corridor and held up his hand to make the wall transparent. They looked into another small room or cell. In the center of it was a large, round, transparent column, and inside this column was a man. Father! Meg screamed.
No.
Wrong call. Don't sue us, Violet soon. So he is.
Yeah, kind of a cliffhanger there. The transparent column was holding their father.
Yes. So in the same conversation where Charles Wallace's body, so Charles is telling them that there's no such thing as murder.
Mm.
That people that are defective or don't fit in are simply put to sleep.
Or have a head cold.
Yeah, no, that's it. Anything defective. Anything that doesn't fit into what they need. Any aberration from the organization is, and then says, oh, well, I'm going to have to take you guys to it. Basically, don't threaten me or I'll take you there, kind of thing.
The weirdest thing, of course, was he said, this is better because nobody isn't happy. I mean, let's just start there. Before we get to Meg, I do want to get to her response, but let's just get, like, people are clearly unhappy there. They live in fear.
Yeah, but I think the difference is they're living in fear. It implies that they can think for themselves. Sorry, not living in fear. Happiness implies that they think and they have a sense of what they like and don't like. Here they don't get told, they get told what they like and don't like. And what they should be, what should make them happy, what doesn't make them happy. The only thing they care about is not disappointing it.
Mm.
Fulfill your purpose and that's it. Well, that was not an intended pun, but there's a pun in there. You know, that the individual is done away with.
Yeah. It just, from my point of view, I see this whole place as deeply unhappy. I kind of get what you mean, whereas if they have no desires of their own, well, if you don't have, like happiness and unhappiness are kind of born, well, you know, that's the Buddhist philosophy. Suffering is born out of desires. So if you have no desires, there is no suffering. So, yeah, I can see it from that point, but I guess, yeah, for me, I equate fear with unhappiness.
I would too, except in this case, it's because it's treating the entire planet as an organism, a single organism.
Right. You don't worry about a single one of your cells.
No, you don't. A single one of your cells, if it's an aberration, your immune system will usually knock it out.
Mm.
Yeah. So this idea of the individual doesn't exist, the concept of the individual not existing. And I mean, as we've said before, this is a pretty blatant, well, it's not blatant. It's known to be a bit of an anti-communism propaganda thing.
Right, right. I actually, after this last chapter, yep. I see that much more strongly than I did when you previously brought it up.
And I mean, I was recently doing a course, funnily, on this whole topic, which was this idea of the definition. So if you have the four dominant schools of thought or human constructs of approach in society, so you've got anarchism, not to be mistaken with anarchy, but anarchism, communism, the romantic notion of the individual, and then the romantic era, and then the materialist individualist perspective on thing. And then we went through these concepts of what does it mean? What is the definition of the individual if you took it to the extreme? So in these things, in the most extreme form, what is the individual? What is society? What is community? What is an institution? So the course I'm doing is about civilization and exploring these ideas of what informs civilization development and growth, and how do you end up with disparate or completely different perspectives coming together and actually working together towards something. And this was more a section that was looking at, well, we've got these four fairly dominant schools of thought that influence how we think and interact in the world, because they're present in some way and in some level. So when you take them to the extreme, what does that look like? And then we were encouraged, now examine your own values and ideas of these concepts and try and identify what schools of thought are influencing it, and then try and reflect on what that actually means in terms of a society. How does that work? And it was interesting because, like, the individual in this situation, we've just been told by the entity that's acting through, or the collective mind that is acting through Charles Wallace, that the individual has been done away with. We can see that institutions still exist because there's an administrative structure. Yes.
You can't get rid of bureaucracy no matter how hard you try.
Well, no, it means that the function of bureaucracy has changed. The function of bureaucracy in this space exists to reinforce the collective, like a stifling level of collectivism.
Yes.
Yep. And collectivism, again, individualism has in its extremes has pros and cons. Collectivism in its extreme has pros and cons. So the question is, how do you reach a point where you have the benefits of social well-being and individual expression and also exploration? And the thing is, the reason you've got this entity saying, well, no one's unhappy, because A, if they were unhappy, it would get rid of them.
Mm.
Yeah. Fear is not considered unhappy. Fear is you want to comply.
Well, yeah, based on the child at the end that they saw who was being negatively reinforced to bounce the ball properly.
Yep.
Yeah, negative reinforcement is still seen to be the preferred motivator for a large portion of our planet.
Even
when we've, you know, from what I've read and seen, a positive reinforcement just does so much better to get a desired effect. Of course, if your effect is power, control, and fear, then of course negative reinforcement is the way to achieve those ends. As you know, the dystopic novels we've read on this podcast exemplify.
Yes. Well, you have the fear of Room 101, for example.
Hmm.
And things like that. So it's this, I mean, it is, you can see the concepts from 1984 very prevalent in this as well. And we were saying it's taking a concept or a school of thought or something and taking it to its extreme. But this is a children's novel.
Yeah.
So it's subtle. Well, it's not that subtle. it's not that subtle, but it's way of exploring it is, it's not with 1984, you had functions that actually had no purpose other than serving the machinery of it.
Yeah. I won't go off on this tangent because this could take up like a half an hour if I really got into it. But, on that note, I finished reading Bullshit Jobs by David Graeber, and there is so much in that book about how our modern world works and how so much of it seems to serve no purpose whatsoever.
Wow. Busy work. It's this fixation with continuous productivity, whereas certain things are just not seen as contributing or being productive. Whereas if you, for example, took the time to make sure that, you know, the kids in the neighborhood have a clean park to play in, that's considered, oh, that's a voluntary thing that you can do, but it's not real work, right?
Well, it goes deeper. Like that, he argues that, and it's, I won't call it Protestant, because oftentimes the blame for this productivity disease kind of gets thrown at the feet of like this Calvinistic Protestant work ethic that has kind of infected mostly the US, but now it's like UK and Australia and a lot of what we call the Western world.
We technically had it the entire time. It's just that it's become more obvious, but yeah.
But that idea with the park you just said, well, according to like the values that seem to dictate how our world is put together, well, because you're actually doing something that gives purpose and meaning and benefits people, well, you shouldn't be compensated for that at all, because you're getting you're getting like a moral value out of it. And it plays into another big part of the book, where it's like the things that actually, the jobs that are needed to keep society running are so poorly compensated, while these bullshit jobs are the ones that give the most wealth and power. Yes.
Yeah.
Idea that, if you're doing something that benefits humanity, well, then that should be enough.
Yeah. There's the way that we treat, service, like it's a given, as opposed to that everything can be a form of service. Like whatever you're doing, as long as it has an impact and a constructive and a positive impact on others and is contributing to the well-being of others in some way, and you are also included in the others, but it shouldn't just solely be only for yourself. I guess that's what the difference here is, that we've got a situation where you've got extreme collectivism dismissing the individual's needs because they're no longer they have no needs.
Mm-hmm.
The individual's not considered in the equation. Whereas in a society that's a bit more balanced, the individual's needs are also considered. But you try and prioritize the well-being of all, which includes the individual who is contributing to said well-being of all.
Because we all have our strengths, and things we want to pursue. And often those things, if we were supported in them, could benefit society, benefit us all.
Well, there was the expression, I still will come back to this expression that was said by Mrs. Watsett, which was the idea of, like, it's not the talents, like, the talents alone are not the important thing. Mm. It's that how you use the talents, like, I don't remember the exact term, but it aligns a lot with, I will say, my personal understanding in life that I try and strive for, which is how you apply those talents for the well-being of others, the impact that you're trying to leave with it. It doesn't mean that, you know, every person who has an artistic skill or an ability to write will necessarily hone those talents, and that will be, and the purpose is, oh yeah, you need to do this only for the society, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
But the thing is, honing those talents is something that we can, and that's, by the way, that's where the romantic individual comes, the romantic notion of individual. There's individualism and individualistic thing. There's a subtle difference. But the one is that you owe your exploration of your talents is what society needs to foster and encourage you to do. And that is, and not for any purpose other than that you explore those talents to the fullest extent. Mm. So individual expression finds its fullest extent. And that doesn't work either, because then you have a whole bunch of people just going ahead and doing whatever they want to further themselves. And they feel that society owes them any opportunity to express themselves. Whereas you kind of want to have something that allows you and gives you the space that fosters the individual to explore their talents to the best of their ability as possible, as is reasonable, but also that can contribute to the bigger picture as well. So those talents then can be expressed in a way that contributes to everyone collectively as well.
Hmm.
Whereas the other way is also the whole only for the collective. Like, you're not allowed to have anything that has no purpose for the collective is useless.
I can't remember if this phrase was actually used in the book, but it feels like, yeah, because relating back to what Meg's response to Charles saying that no one is unhappy here, she says, well, no one's happy either. It feels like everyone's had their edges sanded off.
They're numbed, which is where this whole collective mind comes from, is that we've seen with the red-eyed guy, we saw temporarily the guy in the hall who was just like, no, I'm not willing to get re-educated kind of situation. Mm. I'm not having this retraining business happening. And knowing that that the mind is occupied, the part of the mind is constantly tapped into this collective mind. So, yeah, creepy.
Thought
and
crime.
When they're not, yeah. And when they're not, they get retrained.
Mm.
Well,
we saw that. We saw an example of that with the boy.
Yes. Well, actually, that was the thing. When you take it to the extreme, collectivism is also not going to be there necessarily for... So anyone that is a depletion of the resources that are needed for the collection, for the collective, is sacrificed. So it's a different kind of productivity obsession. You have it in both extremes. You have it in both capitalism and communism in the extremes. Again, extreme situations is this idea of anything that detracts from productivity.
Yes,
is undesirable. Yeah.
There has been, I do call it a bit of a disease, the productivity disease. Because it's infested our generation as well, the idea that, oh, I enjoy doing this hobby, you know, something that I should find joy in, again, for its own purpose. Mm. And then in the back of your mind, there's that productivity disease that go, well, you could make a living off this if you worked a bit harder, if you dedicated more time to it. How can you monetize this thing that brings you joy? How can you squash the joy out of it so it becomes something that earns you a living, which you need? You know, it is this horrific, I'll call it a disease. I think it's a cancer.
Yeah, the expression for that, you could consider that to be an excess, like an obsession with consumerism. And that's where consumerism taints and distorts absolutely everything. Again, every one of us consumes. Like, it's you can't not exist and consume. That is not the issue. But consumerism being the complete and utter, just frenetic levels of activity dedicated to making things that people, that's our Brave New World situation.
Hmm. Just to take up time to distract, to have surface level pleasure.
Yeah. And I think also part of it, this is again something that's been coming up recently, which is this idea of when we have narrow and broad definitions. So narrow definitions and broad, a big thing is having narrow definitions. So if you have a very narrow definition of the concept of success or prosperity.
Yeah.
So if your concept of prosperity is whatever gains me material, me and those that I care about, material and social advancement or accumulation. Whereas you could take prosperity and say whatever enables both myself and those around me and the world at large, for all of humanity, to advance and to materially but socially and also in terms of character and qualities and all those things, that's progressing, that advancing, that we all have opportunities and that everyone is considered and in a just way.
Well, and that's a part of the book as well, the Bullshit Jobs, talking about, I don't think he uses the word malaise, but like this lack of fostering spiritual growth or prosperity or success, mainly because work is not fulfilling, or if it is, it's not well compensated, so that creates issues of its own. But yeah, let's return to the book. Do you have anything else that happened during that chapter that you'd like to focus on?
I'd like the fact that Calvin almost got through to Charles.
And he was not happy about that. Well, the creature was not happy about that.
No. And also the whole idea of Meg calling him out on almost leaving Calvin in the elevator.
Well, yeah, they cannot be separated.
No. And I think that that's also the thing that there is a fear of Calvin, maybe, that is fueling that anger, but also fear that Calvin managed to get through.
Well, and also it took three of the henchmen to pull him off, Charles.
Yeah, so he's physically and also has other prowess. So there was a fear there. I mean, we've got this situation where Meg is extremely emotionally volatile, but that is also the age range she is in, is a thing.
And she's kind of had her universe blown open.
Yes, she's had her universe blown open, but she's also, the fact that Charles Wallace, or the creature that talked through Charles Wallace, was saying, you don't like being different. I think that was a conversation that frustrated the entity through Charles Wallace, which made the entity try and leave him in the elevator. Where Calvin was insisting, no, I like being different. I don't want to be like everyone else. And then repeating it.
Whereas, yeah, Meg said, well, I don't want to be different, but I don't want to be like everyone else either.
Yeah. So it was interesting. So overall, it's going to be like, it's...
There you go. Sorry to cut you up, but yeah, that's, Meg is not one or the other.
Yes. She doesn't want to, she doesn't want to be different, but she also doesn't not want to be different. So she is that in-between space. Whereas Calvin is very staunchly in the, I am happy being different. That's fine. That's good. It's a good thing being different.
But even though he said that, Charles did bring up, but you act like everyone else.
Yes, because he does. He tries to fit in with the crowd at school, but he doesn't fit in at home. Because he's a sport. A genetically distinct or anomalous presentation.
And it is an abusive household as well, so.
Well, it's a neglectful household, which doesn't really help. No. So, we next week we get to know Dr. Murray.
Well, the chapter's called It.
Well, there's that too.
Now, this was written about 30 years before the clown novel, but I have to wonder.
Well,
because also, not to spoil it for those who haven't read it or seen one of the film adaptations, but ultimately, it just took the guise of a clown and was a more of a cosmic horror. Very, very similar to the dark thing, really.
I would not be surprised if this was a novel that Stephen King read.
Mm.
It is one of those books that is, was like, I think you can see why this was a bit of a push in terms of kids' novels.
Just jumping on that as well, you know, we talked, the chapter on the Tesseract, we talked a lot about, and you mentioned it before, but the idea of explaining these complex ideas to children in a palatable way. Once again, that happened here, where Charles just kind of casually throws out, you know about atoms, how they're mostly empty space, how if we took all the empty space out of you, you'd fit on the head of a pin. I mean, everyone knows that. And I think most people reading probably would not have known that. Heck, you know, that's still kind of a wild idea. I don't think I really understood that till my 20s or 30s, and probably from a sci-fi book or something like that, or one of the self-help books I read, trying to, you know, find answers, because a lot of them take science and then go off in their own direction with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, that is one of the wildest things, is that the universe is mostly empty space.
Well, the space between atoms is mostly empty space, and then there's a lot of empty space in the universe because there's big patches where there is no matter. So,
or antimatter / dark matter or whatever that is.
I don't know. That's going into a level of quantum physics that I am not well-versed on and uncomfortable to make statements about. Mm.
But you know, just that idea of, you know, a human being an atom mostly being empty space, and also, Charles just casually going, oh, I rearranged the atoms in this door. Just like, what? You can't walk, put one foot in front of the other?
Yes, it was like, we know also Charles is a particularly unique kind of person.
Mm.
And whether it's Charles or whether it's the creature acting through him, that's going to be the tricky part. Like, is it because Charles has that ability, or is it because the creature has that ability?
And is that pride Charles, or is the creature amplifying that aspect of Charles?
Yes, so many options. I mean, at this point, we're going with the idea that whilst there are no pupils, there is no Charles.
Yeah.
But in terms of the body being able to do things that maybe other bodies could not do, that's another thing. But we know the people in Camazotz can.
Mm. Or maybe only special people in Camazotz, because all those mothers who pulled their boys in, I don't know if they have the ability to just go around rearranging atoms.
No. It would make sense for it to control who has what power. Hmm. So yes. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of, like, it's going to be interesting few chapters. We have now hit, I'm trying to find the percentage. We have hit the 70th percentile.
We're in the final third.
Yes, we are in the final third, and we are, I don't think it's going to be that many chapters to go.
Mm.
But yeah, these are kind of short, sweet-ish books. There is a series, it is a series, first book in the series of the Time, I think it's the Time Quintet. But yeah, it's a interesting series if you haven't read it as a kid. It's kind of interesting to read.
Yeah, I'm very much enjoying it.
Yeah, it's a good series. Like, it explores also different domains of science quite a bit. Like, this is more our quantum physics than our, it is mostly being quantum physics and dimensions and things like that. So, which is in itself, and of course, sociology. Technically. So, it's a fascinating kind of situation. But I'm hoping that next week people will tune in and get the next chapter and get to know it.
Well, that's the thing. And I'm actually glad you didn't make this choice. But, you know, reading it, it is in capital letters. And it would be so easy to, when reading, just go, it. But no, Rue is more professional than I would be. To be honest, I probably would not do that. But the urge to do so would be there.
It, as it is, I tried to make an emphasis on it, but
on it,
on it, but just like it, like just trying to, I tried to put a tone in there. I don't know if I've managed to do it consistently because I was got distracted. That's what happens. I start reading and I get distracted by the reading. So yeah, sometimes, hopefully it'll come across as necessarily sinister as the capitalization of the name implies.
Yeah, there is something sinister about capitalization, isn't there?
But also the fact that, oh, we don't have murder here. We just put people to sleep. Like, ah, that's not at all concerning. Oh, we don't handle it. It handles it. Like, ah, that's not at all creepy. No, not at all. Not at all terrifying.
Do these people wake up? Oh, what a silly question. Hey, look over here.
Yes, like distraction dance. So
and we come full circle and scene.
So, yes. But yeah, on the meantime. So in the meantime, let us, I believe, leave you, dear listeners, with that and remind you that the music at the top of the podcast is composed by Jeff Danna and is the score for the 2003 production of A Wrinkle in Time. The end of the podcast, as always, we have I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. And you can catch me on Twitter at ROOMCMOO, that's Roo McMoo.
I'm over at Dave_the_turnip. You can find our Twitter profile and our Facebook page at SMBSLTpodcast. And you can reach us via email at SMBSLTpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you, you know, what you think of the episode, what you think of the books. If you have suggestions for future books, we'd really like your feedback. And if you listen to our podcast on any platform that allows you to rate or review it, we would appreciate that as well. You know, getting it out in front of more listeners. Onward and upward.
Not at all terrifying. It's okay. It's okay. It'll be fine. So until next time, we hope you have a lovely week and happy reading.
Bye, folks.